Welcome to Supply Chain Next with your host, Richard Donaldson. Join us as we explore the ongoing evolution of supply chain, from the challenges professionals face every day to the ongoing digital transformation of the entire value network.
And good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the next episode of Supply Chain Next. And I am sitting here digitally, virtually with Nathan Williams of MindSpider. And good morning, good afternoon, Nathan.
Good morning, good afternoon to you too, Richard. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. And just to remind everyone, such a global participation here, you are in Germany right now?
I'm in Berlin, Germany.
Wow.
The beautiful, gray, cold place that hopefully we'll see spring soon.
Right. I mean, it's been a chilly, chilly winter, I think, all across the board here. But yeah, I'm sitting here in Scottsdale. You're in Berlin. And it's like, now, you know, the time and distance just doesn't even matter anymore. So great to have you here. Well, Nathan, let's just jump right in. I mean, one of the things that we love to do here is get origin stories, kind of in the comic book Marvel parlance these days. And you have a fascinating origin story. So I'm going to let you tell a little bit about yourself and where you came from and how you found yourself in Berlin, because you don't sound German to me.
No, I'm actually Canadian. Most of my life in Canada, actually. And then I went back to school in, 2010, honestly, to get my MBA and to figure out how to run a business effectively. I've been an entrepreneur most of my life, and and I've seen projects start, projects fail, and I'd always felt there was a missing piece of knowledge. So I went back to school and got that knowledge, and then I said, you know what? It's time for a change. And my wife had visited Berlin. She said, there's a really big startup scene out there. I'm a startup guy. And so I was like, good enough for me. Let's go. So we just happened
right up. That sounds like an entrepreneur. You know what I mean? A digital nomad before it was cool to be a digital nomad.
It's a little bit easier to be a digital nomad before you have kids. I think it would be a little harder for me nowadays. But back then, it was about 10 years ago. And we just up and moved.
Now, when you say you're an entrepreneur, I always want to double click on that one because people fly over it, right? Like, there's people listening to the show. We've got a pretty diverse audience where it goes from people in undergraduate to, retired executives just trying to stay in touch, right? Mm. But, sometimes people kind of fly over that. Like, what did you do? I mean, how did you know that early on? Did you come out of high school and you were building businesses or something? Or like, what made you go like, gosh, I'm a constant tinkerer or something like that?
I think ever since I was a child, I wanted to be an inventor. And that and an archaeologist, because I watched Indiana Jones. But then I realized that wasn't the thing.
You can't combine the two somehow?
I realized that he was more of, a treasure hunting murderer. But he's Bugs Bunny with a hat.
Right.
Anyway,
right.
I figured that I've always loved creating and building and inventing things. Mm-hmm. And in some
Do you have any inventors you hold up as your sort of, who are the ones that you look to and go, oh my gosh.
You know what? Not really. I think that it was just that I've always loved building things and tinkering. And I think that there's the dark side of being an entrepreneur as well, which was that I was always a bit of a lost soul. Mm-hmm. And I never really felt at home going into a 9-to-5 career. And so I would run jobs, but then I would do my own thing, and then I would try and sell some artwork or sell some product. My wife and I made jewelry at one time. We tried to run a youth drop-in center at one point. We did so many different things, and it wasn't until I went back to school and learned about how bigger businesses get run that I started to think back about how my software startups that I had done, what made them succeed and fail, and what I could do differently now that I'm a bit older and a bit wiser. Mm-hmm. And so part of my journey was actually relocating to Europe in order to get myself into a whole new context. Mm-hmm. To say, okay, well, I've had a bunch of smaller projects. None of them really took off back before I went back to school. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go and start over and just see what I can do. And that's what I did. I moved to Berlin and became part of the German startup scene here. There was a new association of startups at the time. Mm-hmm. And they were my first job when I moved here. I just took a job with them.
Okay.
And I said, and they were trying to organize a trip for entrepreneurs from Berlin to San Francisco. And so I said, I can do that.
Okay.
So jumped in with both feet.
And this was when, roughly?
This was 2013.
Okay. And
so we actually went as sort of a, we got 40 entrepreneurs and we took them to San Francisco as along with the vice chancellor of Germany and his official delegation to visit Google and Facebook and all of these, you know, stars of Silicon Valley. And that we called the German Valley Week. And that was sort of my introduction to the German startup scene. And I met a bunch of entrepreneurs and I learned sort of from them. It was a real eye-opener for me, seeing sort of how they started. Because some of them were quite successful.
Yeah.
And with, you know, 100, 200, 500 person companies in everything from software, e-commerce to physical products. And so that, I think, was really sort of a reawakening of my entrepreneurial drive. Mm-hmm. And so it was shortly after that that I was looking at where I would sink my teeth into, and the opportunity found me. And this, the thing is, this is what happens a lot, I find, with entrepreneurs. It's preparedness meets luck.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, the luck side of it was that I was talking with my father. My father is a regulatory, or was at the time, a regulatory expert for Michelin Tire before he retired. And they had a bunch of big regulatory changes. It was costing huge amounts of money, big problems, and just knowing what chemicals were going to be banned, all of that, they all had to be registered. And so I basically built him a platform to be able to track all of these chemicals. And so this is how I got started in regulatory technology. Huh. And so from that, I met people who were having trouble sourcing metals and supply chain. And so over the following 8 to 10 years, I ended up developing an expertise in raw material sourcing, supply chain regulation, this sort of thing in this industrial tech. But I sort of came upon it by happenstance.
Gotcha. And so, but let me double click on a couple things. And we're coming up to MindSpider, but I want to go back to, now that you've been in Berlin for arguably 10 years, we go back to that trip to San Francisco, that fateful trip where you kind of opened up. Now, describe though, and thinking on are there differences? Are entrepreneurs the same globally, right? Is sort of a global question, because are there differences in the entrepreneur philosophy kind of conversation that you find in Berlin versus, say, Silicon Valley?
Oh, absolutely.
And what are them?
And everything has changed a lot in the past years as well, right?
But yeah.
I think there's a big difference between the startup VC game versus maybe a more traditional brick and mortar entrepreneur, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are certain games that get played. Mm-hmm. And in Silicon Valley, it is very much scalable software solutions. And the idea is akin to house flipping, right? You want to meet certain KPIs in order to sell to one of the big boys in trade sale.
That's
really what you want to do.
Right.
In Germany, at least 10 years ago, but even still today, it's much more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And there is financing and there is VC money. Especially today, it's a bit easier. But it was back in the day, it was much harder to raise your A round. A round was the hard one. There was plenty of money for a C round. If you wanted to raise 50 million, you're good to go. If you wanted to raise half a million, you were fine. But that A round was really, really hard because it was sort of the death zone between high risk and provable scalability.
Yep.
Whereas they didn't seem to have that problem in San Francisco, but you had to be known. You had to be part of the group.
Yeah.
And this is what I really found in San Francisco, is that there are cliques of people that know each other. It's not just random people that go up Sand Hill Road. That does happen, but it's a much rarer story. It's more you know someone who knows someone who gets you in, and then you meet this person. That was a big eye opener for me, because I mean, it's a little bit like trying to break into Hollywood.
Yeah. Right? 100%.
It's the same thing. It's you need to know someone that's on the inside of the game, and then you stick with them, and then you end up getting this funding together, and you do a success or a small success, medium success, and you use that to build a big success, or maybe you get a lucky punch. Mm-hmm. But it's all about having a cohort, and you hear the stories too. You know, like these people from Silicon Valley are like the PayPal mafia, right? But, you know, they split off and did 50 other things, and everyone wanted to back them because of their past success. But then they're known. But
funny enough, let me click on that one, because again, I use the exact same example. However, funny that you use, I think this is where you and I, you know, are birds of a feather here. I always still use the PayPal mafia as example, right? Because of what you just said, which is important. They were one of the few groups or cohorts that left a successful startup. And then those individuals went on to pursue and build the next startups and the next startups that were super successful. Reid Hoffman, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. And you can like or dislike them, but their success and track records are crazy good. That's the exception. Go back to your chance, favors, prepare. Most startups are at the right place at the right time. They got that lucky thing. They get the liquidity event, right? And then to your point, everyone's like, oh, well, shit. You guys should be able to do this again. It's rare.
So many things. I think back to, I remember seeing multiple failed startups from very well-known founders, or also even, I mean, just look at Google and all the
right.
They tried to spin off. Whatever happened to Google?
Well, look at internally at Google. I mean, and again, I'm a huge fan of Google. Don't get me wrong, but the uncomfortable truth about Google is search is the only thing that makes money.
Yep.
There's not a single business unit inside of Google that makes money besides search. Well, maybe YouTube. Actually,
YouTube. I was going to say
YouTube. I'm going to say YouTube. You're right. Correct. YouTube for sure. Sorry. Yeah, but that's an acquisition.
Yeah. And this is it. But I think that when you're talking about mentality, it success or failure is almost secondary to the picture of how the game is played and what the mentality is. And there's been a bit more homogeneity between ecosystems in more recent times.
Yep.
But because you end up having deal sourcing for, like, VCs will start deal sourcing overseas more. And but I remember back in 2013, some of the biggest success stories in the Berlin scene actually went to Silicon Valley to raise money.
Interesting.
It just wasn't happening. There was one big one called Gitzy, I remember, that was a fellow named Edie Aldekker, who was a Dutch guy that raised money. Big Berlin success story had to do his A round in Silicon Valley. And then he ended up selling the company to a company called Get Your Guide. And so Get Your Guide is now fairly big. And I just remember that being like one of the hallmark success stories. And he had to go to the US to get money.
Well, I mean, go back to something even more basic, KPIs for the industry, right? I mean, an article I wrote recently is, hey, VC is, again, all credit to you. You guys are the engine and lifeblood behind what's kind of been the innovation, explosion in the last 30 years. Awesome. That's great. But like everyone else, we need to evolve, innovate, change, adapt. And your 30-year-old model of hitting 1 out of 10 might need a little bit more improvement, right? Like, hey, look in the mirror, right? Innovate yourself, right? Maybe you should aim for 20% success rate. And oh, by the way, if you're telling me that your success rate, or I'm sorry, the other way to look at it is you have a 90% failure rate on portfolio selections that have already been a curtailed you don't invest, you go through 100 different views, right? So you've picked, out of all the people you've picked, you selected those and you're still 90% failing. That's not super good as far as I can tell, right?
But it's the tale as old as time.
I know. I'm with you. You throw $1 billion at it, right? And I'm going to at least get one of those $100,000 bets or $100 million bets to 20x and make up for all the failures that I've had. My point is, though, if I look at someone like Harry Stebbings over in the UK, if you haven't run into him, he's a contemporary, I would say. He's a younger, mid-30s VC, and he is absolutely pillaring the VC industry for all the reasons we're talking about. He's saying, we need to change. We need to adapt. We need to evolve, right? And oh, by the way, stop throwing money at all these silly ideas. that worked. And no one's arguing it didn't work. It did work. It absolutely worked. Right.
Well, I mean, I think that we're getting into an area where we're able to see clearly what you would classify as a systemic failure.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Like the it's the exact same model that happened with junk bonds. It's the exact same model mm-hmm. that happened with the 2008 financial crisis.
Right.
People did the math.
Right.
And they realized that doing a large amount of riskier moves.
Yep.
Ended up paying better than a couple of really well thought out, well placed investments.
Yep.
And so they expanded on the risky moves. But by doing that, they actually increased the amount of absolute garbage that went in. And
totally.
Success rate of the risky moves ended up cratering. It's the same thing. Every startup hype bubble happened the same way.
Yep.
The crypto hype bubble that we're going and bursting and going and bursting is exactly the same way. It happens everywhere. And the same thing with high-risk mortgages and like you name it. It's a very common formula. And if you want to be the next rich guy, you do some math, you prove X commodity or X investment, invest in something that's very high risk and you have an like 10% success rate on it. It'll work out. And then you make all your money and everyone else pours it in. And then you plummet down to a 1.5% success rate and the market bottom will fall out of the market again. And history will repeat itself over and over.
Over and over. Absolutely. So definitely see the same thing now. Now that we've sort of critiqued the BC world, let me pull it back though to MindSpider, because, you know, for you to launch MindSpider, which again, I want to ask you to think about this a little bit, because you had such a varied background. You're clearly an entrepreneur, you're a problem solver, right? So I could throw you at just about anything and you probably figure it out, whether it's jewelry or, you know, freaking software as a service. So of all the things in the world that you could have ended up doing, how did you get into supply chain data of all things and launch that? Like that's, you know, my gorging story, like I got thrown at because I got hired. Someone hired me to go figure out a supply chain at eBay. Said, hey, we got this $1 billion supply chain, go figure it out. And that was the door that opened for me. And next thing you know, I'm spending the next 10, 15 years in supply chain. How did you make that choice?
It's funny. It reminds me a little bit about how to tell this story. 2017, okay? My previous company called Savise that I had started with my father, the chemical regulations platform. We had an AI checking for chemical news. It went okay. I sold it to a competitor.
Okay.
It didn't take off in the way I wanted it to. But it was fine. It was an exit. And then I was looking for what to do next. And my father actually came to me in 2017 and said, you know, now, have you taken a look at blockchain? And I said, isn't that just a way to buy drugs on the internet? and he said, no, you check it out. And he sent me a TED talk with, I think it was Tim Draper who was giving it. And went through Ethereum and all of the things you could do with it. And this was giving me the idea of, is there a way to apply it to the industry that I've just found myself in? Right.
Okay.
Is there a way of applying it to authenticity and trust in supply chains? And so we were looking at chemicals at first, and I didn't really see how to apply it back then. I do now, but not back then to chemicals. Mm-hmm. But a lot of my contacts told me directly, like the conflict mineral use case is the hard one. And that's how I got into it, was with conflict metals. So gold, tin, tantalum, tungsten that were coming out of DRC, making sure that they weren't funding slavery and child labor. That was sort of my entry into the whole supply chain world. And so what I did I did two things. First of all, I started the podcast because I wanted to learn everything there was to learn about blockchain. And I figured the way I would do that is I would interview as many successful blockchain founders as I could. And if you want to talk to blockchain or any startup founder, they do not have time to talk to you. But if you've got a show, then they will gladly come on your show.
Exactly.
That's what I did. And I had 180 some odd episodes over
two. Wow.
It's on Spotify. It was called Analysis and Chains. I stopped doing it in 2019. I ran out of time, but it was funny. One of my friends came to me just not 2 months ago and said, "Nathan, you interviewed Sam Bankman-Fried?" And I
didn't
realize it at the time, because back at the time, he was, before he launched FTX, he was not well known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And but it was one of my last episodes on Spotify.
That's cool. Oh my God. I just pulled it up. I didn't realize you had that. That's awesome. Okay.
You know what's funny is that our whole conversation was actually quite a good conversation about the importance of trust in order to get big businesses to put money into crypto.
Oh my God. And I'm like, yeah, right. You're just like, okay.
Nevertheless, that was one of the things that I ended up doing. And then the second thing was that I talked to everybody who was in the industry about what had been tried, what worked, what didn't work, et cetera. I ended up just cold calling the European Commission and asking for an invitation to the OECD Forum on Conflict Metals so I could meet everybody.
Here's a soundbite question for you, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you also were doing something that I think needs to call out here, which is blockchain, like a lot of technologies, was sort of hyped up, right, because of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
But people started conflating, you know, cryptocurrency with blockchain as a distributed database that is about trusted data, blah, blah, blah. So where I'm headed is, the question is, you were also astutely analyzing blockchain long before people are still kind of trying to figure out like what to do with it, right? Because everyone was like, "Oh, I'm gonna have a blockchain this and blockchain that. I'm gonna have a blockchain tire, for God's sakes." You know what I mean? It's just like, Jesus. I got everything in blockchain. So how do you define blockchain, right? Question one. And then question two, how are you looking for use cases to use that blockchain, right, in an effective way? Because blockchain is not for everything. I have this conversation with a lot of people, just like you do. And I'm like, okay, it's a database, right? It's a specific database, kind of. Yeah, all right. This is why I'm asking the question. Go ahead.
I mean, the way I usually explain blockchain to someone that isn't technical is, I would say it's a way of keeping a record of data or small amounts of data or transactions that doesn't require you to trust anybody to be sure that the data is unchanged and unchangeable.
It's
data security.
Yep.
And I would look at blockchain as the way I would explain it in a slightly more technical way would usually be how it works. Mm-hmm. Imagine you're trying to make a bank transaction, right? Mm-hmm. The way that you would do it is I would call up my bank, or I would go on the internet and say, "Bank, please transfer €5 or $5 from my account to Richard's account."
Mm-hmm.
But what if there was no bank?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that if I tell Richard, "Okay, I'll keep this record of transactions myself, and so will you," the problem is, if we've got a third person, they might not hear the transaction, and I might have an opportunity to cheat the system and double spend my money, giving it to you and to the third person, and then they wouldn't have a way of reconciling their notes. This is just a technological algorithm that makes it so that everybody can be sure that they have the correct version of events. And that's about as deep as you need to know.
Correct.
But because everybody knows they have the correct version of events,
mm-hmm.
if you've got a bank transfer, you can have a little memo field in it, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
And if that bank transfer, if those transactions are unchangeable, anything you put in that memo field will also be unchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
So then what you can do is, you can do something like what we do. We made a digital product passport.
Mm-hmm.
And you can encrypt that digital product passport into a small code, mm-hmm. and store that code in one of those transactions, and it will be unchangeable until the end of time.
Mm-hmm.
Then anybody who gets that digital product passport,
mm-hmm.
can use the same process to put it into a code, compare those two codes and say, yep, this is original. It's unchanged. Nothing has changed about this product passport. And so that's how you can make sure that a larger amount of data is unchangeable. So if you've got a product passport, if you've got an identity for a physical product, like a ton of tin or a shipment worth of gold, mm-hmm. and you have all of the information about how much it weighed, where it came from, the carbon emissions, and you want to be sure that this data is authentic, that whoever put it into the system mm-hmm. didn't then go and change the record, that they're not bribing authorities by keeping two sets of books, mm-hmm. things like that, mm-hmm. then you can take that, or you can have the system automatically take that product passport, encrypt it, grind it down to a code, and then compare that to the code that's on the blockchain. Mm-hmm. And then you can say, yes, this data that I've received is the data that was put in. And that might be of limited use if you trust your customer or if you trust your supplier. But in a scenario where you've got maybe 8 players, mm-hmm. or 10 players, where rocks come out of the ground and then get passed to a refiner and then get passed to a trader and then go halfway around the world, then it's quite useful.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, wonderful description, right? And 100% agree, obviously. Now, I'm going to double click on the question, though, which is, here you are, early advocate and exposure to blockchain. Ooh, there's something cool here, so I'm going to go do something with blockchain, right? And you're also describing in another world, we have all sorts of examples, you know, the provenance of artwork, right, is a similar concept. This is the provenance or the, you know, Carfax data that you might find in the United States with cars, but it's the asset record at the end of the day with
digital
verified and trusted data, right, that is immutable in a way, right? And so that's sort of the debt, but then you sort of said, okay, I'm going to apply this now to quote supply chain. And the supply chain is big. Could be pharmaceuticals, could be raw goods, could be metals, could be all sorts of stuff. You have the applicability. I mean, you're describing a framework that should be applied to the whole supply chain. MindSpider today, which again, kudos for launching it with a blockchain backend. How did you, again, kind of, what have you found through that? Because you launched this, 4 years ago, 5 years ago now?
Yeah.
Ish. So you're right. Your timing is excellent. It seems like the digital wave and transformation is coming. So it's a little bit, you know, pushing a little bit of water uphill because you're kind of early, but that's the normal entrepreneurial thing.
I would classify myself as a bit early.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I mean, we all are. I mean, that's, therein lies the challenge that most entrepreneurs face is timing the wave, mm-hmm. right? It's like surfing. You know what I mean? Like if I go too early, I don't catch the wave. If I go too late, I don't catch the wave. I got to time it just right. And similarly here, it's like, I mean, sure, you know, we as entrepreneurs see where the world's going. We know it's going there. The hardest thing, and our enthusiasm is in fact what we have to keep in check, because we have to recognize that we've been thinking about things that most people in the world probably will never even think about. Solving supply chain blockchain issues is pretty geeky in the weeds. You know what I'm saying? And most people are,
this is why we get along.
Well, that's true too. But you know, I've seen the story over and over again where a lot of technologies are just 5, 10, 15 years too early, right? And this is no different. Anywho, but your time, I don't think you were so early that you missed the boat, you know, like you did a little bit early, but whatever, that's fine. At least you got the way you're getting away. So now I'm coming back to the question though, which is MindSpider has found itself kind of in some certain specific supply chain. There's certain parts of the supply chain that's more open to this than others. The whole supply chain, fast forward 10 years, will be on something like this, guaranteed, right? Whether you figure it out, I figure out, we all figure out, we're going to figure that out. Like that's almost an inevitable conclusion. Now the question is how do you guide MindSpider to take opportunities with what you guys are doing today? And where are you finding that? What parts of the supply chain? Because I look at pharmaceuticals, which I know you're not in yet, but that's ripe for what you're doing, right?
I'm familiar with how blockchain gets applied to the pharmaceutical industry, even though that's not my area of regulatory expertise. But
right.
I can tell you a couple of things, Richard. It would be a lot easier or a lot more preferable for me to tell you about just how smart I am. and how I planned all of this out, as opposed to
I know for fact already.
Trial and error.
And there is a facetiousness that's coming out right now. I get it. I love it.
It's the, you know, when we got started,
yeah,
our original idea, we was a chain of custody from end to end, which sounds like a great idea until you think about it at all.
Yep.
And the and we actually did a project of chain of custody from end to end, and chain of custody was actually built into the protocol, and it was actually one of the most advanced, interesting protocols that for doing this. But there was only one problem, is that it was completely unworkable in a real scenario.
Right.
And so, but we did it. We did it with some of our partners. We tracked tin that came out of a mine. We also tracked some lead that was in a lead battery supply chain. The problem with it was that the original idea we had was you start at a mine, you give it a speed limit. You say, oh, look, you're going to produce like 15 tons or whatever per month. And then they can produce like almost like a token or an NFT. And then you pass it from token to token, you ensure that not too much enters the supply chain. And the only problem with that is 99% of the time, you're not dealing with the beginning of the supply chain. You're dealing with somewhere in the middle. And you don't have all of the actors all at once agreeing to use a system. And so we had to go back to the drawing board. And we said, okay, well, first of all, how do we do it so that we can deal with a company, a section of the supply chain that has a problem at a time, and which sections have the most problems? Mm-hmm. And so we identified a few because they wanted to work with us. And so we ended up doing some work in Rwanda with our partners down there in the tin industry. And they had regulatory needs. They had to prove that they did that chain of custody from mine to smelter. And so we also, and so they had bags and they had tags and they had that history. And to sell internationally, they had to make sure that all the material, all of the, came from sealed bags that had actual locations that were tracked. And so like, it was quite, you know, it's quite robust what you need to be able to prove in order to get an export license there.
And I'm assuming, and again, just to double click on that, and again, I don't want to fly over things that are obvious to you, but may not be obvious to everybody in the audience, which is, you know, in Rwanda, we're not talking conflict diamonds, but it's the same principles, right? We're looking for ethical mining practices and ensuring that there's not slave labor being involved. And so the tag on the bag or container is the only way to sort of, you know, tag that this has come from the proper spot. You know, I haven't used child labor or whatever.
Right.
Exactly. Because you have government involvement there. But what you want to be sure is to be able to prove internationally when you're exporting your tin that you've done the traceability so that you've proven that the metal has some sort of provenance within the country, that it wasn't smuggled over the border from DRC.
So here's a question for you. And again, I'm getting into the weeds here. But so in a way, we're taking a physical asset, tin, coming out of the ground, and we're trying to assign a digital, ironically, twin or data to that asset. The minute we've identified it, it's almost like we should digitize, right?
Yeah.
And start assigning data to that asset as it starts moving through the supply chain, right? Here, what you've done is essentially said, okay, I'm pulling the tin out, I've extracted it, I've put it into a bag. This is the first chance I'm putting data to this physical item, if I'm not mistaken, because there's no preceding data that I'm aware of, maybe the mine exploration data or something, or?
It's not really, the thing is, that's a bit overkill, right?
Yeah.
Like, when you're talking about doing this type of traceability,
yeah,
you can go as deep as you want, but there's only so much that's required,
yep,
and there's only so much that people are willing to pay for, because every time we do this, it adds... this sort of thing.
Yep.
And right now, because if you've got a location where you have requirements, then part of your value proposition is I'm reducing the cost of these requirements.
Right.
If you don't have those requirements, like we also do a lot of work in Peru, then you have to have a different value proposition. Maybe the value proposition is we can help you help your product stand out against the untracked products that might be from, you know, worse scenarios. They might have higher carbon emissions, right? Things like
that. But still more data where I'm going, though. You're still assigning data to those assets. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. But I think the difference is that if you're in Africa, it's more likely that you will need to have data from the point of extraction. Whereas if you're in somewhere like America, maybe someone else tracked it. Maybe they have internally tracked that it came from this location, but maybe it's only required that you put the data on at the point of export. And that's fine. You know, it really depends on what the use case is. Mm-hmm. Because one thing that we learned by doing this is just because you've tracked something from a physical location doesn't mean you've reduced the risks. Because like if you're operating, for example, in DRC, mm-hmm. one of the big risks is that the truck will be robbed along the way and that you will have collected illegal taxes and then you would have given taxes to an armed conflict group and funded terrorism.
Oh, shit.
And that, you knowing it came from this mine or this location doesn't help you with that, right? And so there's other data that you can start to track in order to verify that. But different supply chain risks come with different data that you need to collect, and it's always going to be a bit of an arms race. But this was sort of our phase two, right? It was going in there and sort of learning this and looking at what tracking systems existed, getting that onto the blockchain, and then being able to demonstrate that internationally.
Mm-hmm. So then let's bring forward a little bit. So again, good entrepreneur story. You got a kind of a vision, an idea, basically a theory. You bring it to market. I'm going to use blockchain is sort of my how, right? I mean, there's a data discrepancy among supply chain assets. Okay, that's the working theory. I'm going to solve it using a blockchain, you know, methodology, and I'm going to start to kind of live and learn as I go through the application of this and pivot and adjust and all the stuff that we read about, right? This is how the sausage is made, right? It's ugly. It's not like, we see all the memes, but it's not as pretty as you think. And it's usually a lot of guesswork and it's a lot of failures and it's how you respond to those failures and pivot and adjust and how quick and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so kind of come forward a little bit though. So now you've kind of been playing at it for 5 years. You're also at a time frame that I find fascinating because now that wave is truly cresting. The value proposition that you tried to sell 5 years ago was people might have been a little bit like, huh? Like you had to find people who had already been thinking about it. Whereas now I bet there's more of a pull. What you've been doing is the right thing all along. Now more people are sort of past the hype curve a little bit, or where we are on that hype curve. We're just crossing the chasm, right?
I would agree.
Yeah. So how does that change? How do where we are today confirm what you're doing? And then how do you continue to build what MindSpider's doing? Because the underlying proposition is not going to change for the next 10 years, right? But what have you learned to kind of bring where we are today with what you guys are doing?
I think the number one thing I learned is that people and companies know they want something, but they don't know what they want.
Yeah.
No, seriously though, a lot of companies do have pain points and they have trouble, but it's like being a doctor. You've got to do a bit of a diagnosis, right? Yeah. Like they can tell you it hurts here. They can tell you, oh, I've got these symptoms. They can tell you, hey, there's this, I've been asked about this regulation. Hey, I'm trying to get my material to be more, traceable. Okay, what does traceability mean to you? Oh, I'm not sure. Like, and so you got to sort of hold their hand. And I think that, and the different verticals and different types of companies actually need very, very different data. And,
right.
And so I think that where we're at in the wave is at a point where we're seeing the symptoms are my investors are asking me to get money, or I'm a new producer and I need to compete with the big boys. And so something that'll help set me apart is transparency or a new government regulation has come in and I want to be the first behind it so that everyone sees that I'm compliant and will buy from me or things like that. We've actually expanded to do both upstream and downstream work. We've got quite a network of companies that are in the battery space, for example, because it was sort of a natural progression when you're dealing with these type of critical metals, and they And we ended up doing some or getting involved with some fairly large European Commission funded projects for battery recycling, circular economy, and things like that. And so when we're working in those areas, you've got a very different regulatory requirement. They want to be able to recycle the batteries. They want to to be careful about antitrust. They want to collect the data that's required for the European battery regulation and for the Inflation Reduction Act in the States. And so it's different sets of data than maybe exporting raw metal from South America or Africa. Mm-hmm. But the concept is roughly the same. And so this is sort of has brought us to ask the question, okay, well, how can we meet these very divergent needs that have this common thread of digital twinning, data transparency and provenance and mm-hmm. data authenticity attached to them? Mm-hmm. And so that sort of guided our development as a company.
So, okay, so now you're coming into an area too that is hot, right? Batteries, lithium, right? Mm-hmm. So the metal that underneath the covers, and there's a few other traces, but lithium is really the arguable metal that everyone's trying to get after, right? So, and I just did a quick back of the envelope study the other day, and I know that over the last 10 years, we've mined about 700,000 metric tons of lithium. That's public mm-hmm. record. It's like all metals. We can actually, the data available we'll tell you exactly what we've mined, you know, but now we have 700 million metric tons of lithium that's been mined that's out in the world above the soil. In theory, mine spiders, you're trying to go out and connect to all that to see where it is, because it's probably in a battery somewhere. And then you're providing then this data back to, and I'm actually kind of curious about this, like what does the German regulatory environment require of the returned battery to then be recycled? Like, what do they need to know? Like, what's?
Believe it or not, the biggest challenge with battery recycling is the hazards.
Okay.
Right? Because the thing is, if you've got 1,000 kilograms of lithium, a battery that's mostly lithium,
right,
and it's in a car accident or something like that, it could very easily explode. And
right.
So the safety, transportation, chemical makeup to manage the processes, those are all quite important. There's other requirements about the traceability of the metal, but I think it's more about the cobalt. Okay. There's also requirements on carbon emission. To be honest, I'm not the expert in the regulatory requirements. It's quite an extensive document, the European Battery Regulation, and I did read a summary of the most recent draft, but it hasn't even been finalized yet, as far as I'm aware. But we're seeing sort of the direction that it's going. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the requirements are around, like, actually to make sure that it is able to be recycled and and sort of what recycling looks like.
Right.
Because recycling alone is just a huge challenge with these batteries. And if you've got, if you've got, say, you know, 350 million batteries that are going to be on the road by 2030, then that's $7 to $10 trillion worth of batteries.
Well, you can back into the demand, right? So all of a sudden now you put my head immediately goes to the MindSpider platform, right? Mm-hmm. And I start thinking in my head, okay, I got two sets of stock that I'm actually wanting to track. Traditionally, we use the linear supply chain, extract virgin resources out of the ground. But what I want to do is begin to account for all the non-virgin circular supply that's above the ground. That's why I keep referencing this. There's 700 million-ish metric tons of mined lithium that's above the soil. That is circular supply. And it's too different. I still have all the reserves of lithium that's in the ground, right? That's the speculative geological surveying of what's out there. But I have a known entity of 700 million metric tons of lithium sitting above the ground in various states of use or age or whatever. And I know the life cycle of a battery, kind of like in my old world in data centers, right? I knew when I put a rack of servers in my data center, that rack of server after it was commissioned was coming out in 3 years. We had it down to a prescriptive schedule. I'm pretty sure I could probably look at the longevity of lithium in a battery and tell you that 5 years, I'm just making this up, 5 years is the lifespan of a now, you know, lithium in a battery, whatever, I'm just making it up. So I know that battery is going to come out after 5 years or need to be replaced or 10 years or whatever that number is. So I actually can begin to assign when of those 700 million metric tons above the ground, which is coming out for recycling first. And by the way, let's just say we've solved recycling. And that I'm going to plug here, you know, Aqua Metals or Redwood Metals. I mean, there's some really cool, innovative companies that are doing, attacking this very problem. But I know that I, the Mind Spider could tell me, I have 70 metric tons, you know, coming available for recycling if I'm connected to all that. And oh, by the way, I can begin to forecast based on what you just said that I know there's going to be, again, I'm just making this up, you know, 100 million electric cars needing 100 billion batteries of this size in the next 10 years. I know I need this much stuff. So how do I begin to map against my resources in both the virgin and non-virgin circular? You know what I mean? Like you complete the
loop. Honestly, Richard, I think it's the wrong approach.
Oh, great.
I think it's the wrong approach. I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. Is that that approach for like, it definitely solves a pain point, right? The pain point is, where's the supply? How do I plan for it? Can I do prescriptive mapping, this sort of thing? The problem with using item-based traceability for that is that you have to have everything on it.
Yeah, correct. Great.
Then and it's harder to take into account the data gaps and whereas, you know, if you know that sort of what's there, like on a company by company level, right? Like if you're, I don't know, an OEM, an automotive OEM, you've got a plan for 500,000 batteries in X year, and you know that they've got a 5, 10, 15 year lifespan, depending on the model of the battery and what the recycling is. And so from your perspective, the question really comes down when you're doing this sort of planning is, how do we manage recycling? Like, is there going to be vertical integration there? Because we've got our own form factors, we know how our batteries are built, and maybe you just vertically integrate to solve this problem, as opposed to thinking on sort of a more countrywide scale and thinking, okay, well, we've got, you know, 15 different battery manufacturers and, you know, 150 million batteries in this country versus that country. And how can we plan for circularity? And that's really more of a large aggregate data play. Because getting the data from like each 1,000 kilogram battery or whatever, and then adding it up, it's actually going to be much more prone to error.
Well,
it's any reason, like when we got started, my reasoning for this.
Yeah.
When we got started, we had this idea of a chain of custody being the way to solve supply chain issues with things like slavery, child labor, and that sort of. And the problem is that we could get a really, really good, completely secure supply chain for like a kilogram.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that even if I got all of the metal that Google or Apple or one of the big boys used, what's everyone else going to use? You haven't solved the problem because then you still got you've sucked up all the responsible material off the planet. You've got 100% tracked, and that's great for you, but you haven't done a thing for the problem.
Yep.
And that's why I think it's things like predictive maintenance, predictive supply planning, things like that, that traceability plays an important role for regulation and in trust and in, like, there's a lot of different use cases, but I don't think that it's the right approach for something that's sort of on the grand scale like that.
And let me double click on that though. Is it because it's just too hard of a problem to solve for? Because I'm gonna push back a little bit, because I think you answered your question by stating what the solution is. Everyone has to be on a common platform, right? And the reason I'm gonna say that is when I look at autonomous vehicles, right, and self-driving cars, much similar system requirement. It's either on or off. Because if I have any human being driving that car in the middle of a computer automated system, it's gonna fuck the computer system up. That's the free radical that you don't need in the system. It's the same thing in the supply chain, right? I need to get all the benefits. I need to have the whole supply chain kind of under one common kind of view, in a sense, to get this sort of information. But to get there, it's going to be painful. It's going to be hard. And people are going to be sort of focused on what's for me here now. And you're talking about the reverse logistics, the reverse of procurement, right? Mm-hmm. So IKEA is doing this right now. Cisco's doing this right now. Mercedes is doing this right now. IKEA basically just rolled a program out 2 years ago. Ship us all your used furniture back. We're going to vertically integrate a reverse logistics, reverse, you know, back-end circular supply chain, reuse, recycle, you know, refurbish, you know, breakdown component. They're figuring it out for themselves. I'm kind of, my brain says, that's awesome. Great. All you individual companies can do that, build that. But just like procurement ultimately started to cut, procurement was, did the same thing. We've seen this story before. Procurement was a vertically integrated company specific skill set that eventually went into more of the, I need a common manufacturing platform because the supplies I'm pulling from, no one owns exclusively. Right. And so, yes, that took decades, right? But if I look at manufacturing now and procurement, it's kind of distributed. And, but it didn't start that way, is my point. And it says we're going through the same process. It's just the reverse of it in the circular side. We have to develop these skills. Yeah, go ahead.
You may be right, Richard. I think I see part of this as also a data limitation.
Yeah.
Like I remember speaking with someone a few months ago about the concept of a digital product passport in general, because there are regulations coming for digital product passports that are more generalized for different product classes.
Yep.
And the person said, imagine for a second, just one product. Cell phone, mm-hmm. right? Imagine a passport for a cell phone.
Yeah, right.
With the number of cell phones that are out there, if every single one has a digital product passport that includes not only its the cell phone itself, but also its maybe five major components,
mm-hmm.
right? Then you're talking something on the order of I think it was 100 billion data points, and so quite large. And so then first of all, it's liability risk. Who's going to take liability for all for hosting all of that data, which is connected personally? Mm-hmm. Second of all is, how are you going to manage and require the data to be stored in a common location or centrally? Basically, it wouldn't happen. A country doesn't want it, want that responsibility. A private company shouldn't be trusted with that responsibility. So it needs to be decentralized. Now, the problem with decentralization is that you then have different companies making different choices for the data. So mm-hmm. it then becomes that the solution to this is standardization of data. But then if you've got standardization of data, the problem has always been there are 15 standards out there. So now we need a standard that's going to take them all together, but then not everyone adopts it. So it's now just 16 standards are out there.
Are you familiar with GS1?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, right. So that's exactly what they do. But for the consumer world, they've been at it for 20 years. It's still not done.
Yeah.
To your
exactly.
point.
And right? to their credit, they're very successful.
No, exactly. That's my point. But but that's a kind of the reality, right? This is not something that's going to happen overnight. You know, we have to make this shift. We have to invest in the next 10, 20 years. It's like climate change.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I get fed up because they're like, well, this isn't going to happen in my lifetime. It's a very much, in this sort of myopic view of things, right? It's the same principle. No one is going to jump into climate change for the very reasons you're pointing out. But we're having to tell them, like, you've got to start thinking longer term. You've got to start thinking in terms of decades and, the hundreds of years, right? Because that's how this is. So
Don't get me wrong, Richard. I'm in the business. I'm a big believer that there are solutions to this.
Right, right.
I see different tools being used for different things. I've got a hammer, but I'm just trying to think that not everything is a nail.
Totally.
The things that are absolutely nails.
Yeah.
In my case, are things like cross-border declarations, carbon emissions tracking, value-add data, identity for digital asset management and digital twins, things like mm-hmm. that. Mm-hmm. Recycling instructions, handling provenance. Even something as simple as this is very relative to the battery space is the person who worked on this battery trained to work on that, right? These are things that are very relevant for this type of use case. When you start to get into sort of wider use cases, you absolutely could for sure have maybe not a complete solution, but a solution that's large enough with infrastructure that and government backing that has basically has enough incentive that everyone uses it, right?
Yep.
And so the incentives are, it should be cheap as free, right? Like, yep. Cheap or free, yep. It should be common enough to like just a digital identity document or an ID standard or something, and it should be cross-border. Now, I guarantee you that, you know, if US builds one, then China will say want something else, right? Sure. And so it'll never be universal, but it doesn't have to be.
Yep.
It just has to be widely enough adopted that the major players won't feel comfortable not using it.
Yeah, totally.
And so then you've got, and that's what happens, you know, at these large scales. But when you're talking about something that's meant for individual product tracking, I know that there's a lot of resistance because the people that really need that tend to be disconnected from the purchasing process.
Totally. So let me.
That needs to be sort of bridged.
And this is, I told you at the beginning of the show, and I said it in almost every show, I look at the clock here and I'm like, Jesus, 60 minutes. Okay. So first and foremost, we're going to have another episode because I got to follow up with you because there's just too much being left on the table. But I also want to leave you with a few minutes left, kind of as we're winding down. Tell us a little bit about kind of what's going on for you guys coming out of this, you know, sort of weird last couple of years, but looking forward. Like, again, I think your timing is amazing. You've built a business that's obviously generating revenues and stuff. I think you're solving a problem that you clearly identified 5-6 years ago, right? That's been proven out. Now people are waking up to that. That happens. Where do you see this going over the next couple of years? Where do you see you and MindSpider and just even the world of this sort of, you know, digital passport kind of taking hold? Because we're looking at a few years. This is not, I mean, I'm teeing up what venture investors should be hearing, right? Like, this is a few years in the making. We're still at the early stages of it. Where do you see it going?
Well, I can tease a couple of things.
Yeah.
I absolutely see this, see transparency being connected to the purchasing and sales process.
Yeah.
I think that that's the missing link for changing the way this industry works. Because the thing is, if you look at anything in raw materials, mining, minerals, it's broken. It's not just that it's intransparent. It's that it's really inefficient. There's all sorts of cobbled together problems with it, and from country to country to different places. It often operates with on paper in a good case and not and completely opaquely in a bad case. And I think that those days are coming to an end, and partly because we're seeing such demand for these metals, right? If you would have asked me when I got started at MindSpider, all of the companies that I talked with that are metal producers had warehouses full of material that they were trying to sell. Now they're all basically, you know, completely in demand. It's a complete seller's market, and we've seen the prices of these metals, critical metals, go through the roof.
Right.
And obviously there's a lot of instability because of geopolitics, but at the end of the day, companies can't continue to operate with this type of uncertainty, right? And so connecting this type of information to the actual buying process is going to be coming in the next few years. Now, what that looks like will vary depending on whether it's with big companies or small companies, but it absolutely will need to be part of the buying process to say who has the lowest carbon emissions.
Mm-hmm.
Who can tell me where this came from and provide some proof?
Uh-huh.
Does this come from a recycled source so I can meet my recycled content requirements?
Mm-hmm.
Are there tax credits?
Mm-hmm.
If I buy from this or that producer based on their location and based on their ESG record, or will this help with my own credit rating?
Mm-hmm.
If I purchase from one supplier versus another based on supply chain risk, these are all going to come into play. And that connection to the purchase process and to the financial stream, I think is really what's going to start to accelerate the adoption.
Nice. Well, with that then, and I'll close out a little bit, you obviously open to networking. How do people find you? How do people keep track of not only you, but then what MindSpider's up to over this next year, right? Are you guys doing conferences or speaking, or what's sort of?
We're most active on LinkedIn. I do go to a number of different conferences every year, although to be perfectly honest with you, I tend to sort of go at the last minute and make decisions.
Right.
I'm not the most planned person, but if a good opportunity comes along, I'll be there.
Yep.
And I can always be reached through LinkedIn is the easiest way.
Well, what I'm going to throw you at, and it's just because, again, this is a small world. Part of, like you said earlier, is, you know, having conversations with thought leaders. But if you look at the work of the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals, or CSCMP, they're a North American heavy supply chain organization. But I think it's one of the world's largest. They're just putting their foothold into Barcelona this year. So it's just one I would throw out there if you haven't heard of them. I think that's one organization to keep an eye on when it comes to supply chain professionals, because there's a bunch of stuff for procurement, you know, and other groups, but supply chain is sort of this weird one. And, you know, it's hard to find, because there's sort of like this, you know, where do I go find circular people? Well, traditionally I might go find them at, you know, investment recovery associations, or kind of the disposition side of things. And even that's, you know what I mean? Like, even the question, like, where do I find supply chain people? That's hard.
Yeah.
So I just kind of throw, you know, and I know you're big on LinkedIn, and that's huge, but that's awesome. So again, 60 minutes, going to have you back on. You know, what you guys are doing is amazing. The whole story that you've had is unbelievable. People can learn from you just as an entrepreneur. But then, more importantly, driving the conversation into this area of digital transformation, digital twinning, and transparency. I mean, you're just hitting on all cylinders right now. So it's really cool to watch. Really just a pleasure to hear what you've got going on.
Well, you're way too kind, Richard. Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And the time just flies by when we get to
right, it does. Awesome. Well, listen, go have a great day. We'll talk, okay?
Sounds good. Thank you so much.